Kia ora and welcome to Goodfellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Auckland Faculty of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and today I welcome to the podcast Kathy Stevenson and Rose Sylvester and a special guest, Noah. Today we are discussing the impact of myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, on young people. Kathy is a part-time GP at Māori Ora Victoria University of Wellington and works at the college as the clinical lead on the GPEP program. Her interest in ME/CFS has come from the desire to provide better care and support for her patients, many of whom were having to educate her about the latest evidence approach to ME/CFS. She is hugely grateful to the team at ME Awareness for co-authoring an article on this topic with her and providing her with best practice guidance. Rose Sylvester is a clinical psychologist who lives with close family members who have ME/CFS. This has necessitated long periods of time away from her career to be their full-time carer. To fill the gap that work has left, Rose has become involved in ME education and advocacy and has joined Kathy on several projects to offer support to GPs and other health professionals to understand more about this common and severely debilitating condition. Rose has also initiated a support and information network for carers of young people with ME/CFS and related conditions. Finally, Noah, a remarkable young man who has ME/CFS, will share his experiences with us. Kathy, can you start, please, by telling us what ME or CFS is and how many people are affected?
Yes, and Kira Louise, and thank you so much for giving us this opportunity today. We're very grateful. I think the first thing to stress is that ME or ME/CFS, which is now the kind of widely accepted term that it's referred to by, is a serious chronic complex disease that can really dramatically limit the activities of those who suffer from it. And we know that it affects multiple systems in the body, including the immune system, cellular metabolism, neuroendocrine pathways, and the cardiovascular system. We don't fully understand the pathophysiology yet, but one of the key features seems to be that at a cellular level, people with ME/CFS aren't able to produce the same amount of energy compared with people who don't have it. ME/CFS is a spectrum disorder, so some people are only mildly affected, but some people, sadly, are very severely affected. And if we look at epidemiology, the prevalence is thought to be between around 0.4 and 1%, although the vast majority of those patients don't have a definitive diagnosis. So this roughly equates to between 20,000 and 40,000 New Zealanders. So that's the same number of New Zealanders that have chronic hepatitis C, or a fifth of the number that have ischemic heart disease, or around one child in every three classrooms. Now, ME can affect all ages, races, and socioeconomic backgrounds, and we think that there's a bimodal onset, so there's certainly a peak during adolescence and another peak of onset in the 30s and 40s. Females outnumber males by over 3 to 1, and interestingly, this is the similar ratio that we see in most autoimmune conditions. And we also know that genetics play a role, so many families with ME/CFS will have either two children or a parent and child affected. And in terms of the course of the disease, many sufferers will improve, but will kind of plateau well below their pre-illness functionality and then have a lifelong pattern of relapse and remission. And tragically, only around 5% will completely recover, and a subset will actually progressively get worse. Now, in terms of its relationship to viral infections, which is, you know, something that a lot of us, I think, understand, it's thought that around two-thirds of ME/CFS cases may have a viral trigger. And the most common ones are things like herpes, EBV, CMV, influenza, and now obviously SARS-CoV and COVID-19. So while viral triggers can be identified, it doesn't necessarily suggest causation. So these infections may simply be a final point in a kind of cumulative process. And there are other less common triggers as well. So things like non-infectious immune provocations like anesthetics, physical trauma, and also chemical exposure can do it as well. But for some people, there's no identifiable trigger, and onset can be completely insidious.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kathy. So before we move on to discuss the symptoms of ME/CFS in more detail, There have been a number of myths created around this illness or condition, and mistrust has come as a result. I wonder if you can comment on this.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the biggest barriers that sufferers from ME/CFS face, to be honest. Firstly, I think that the names that have been given to this condition over the years haven't helped. So over the decades, it's been variously known as chronic fatigue syndrome, Tapa Nui flu, Yuppie flu, and lots of other things as well. And to my mind, these names seem to kind of trivialize the condition. So they suggest that it's either self-limiting, as a flu would be, or that fatigue is the only or dominant symptom, and that somehow pushing through that fatigue or tiredness could be the key to a cure. I also think the fact that we can't prove in the clinical setting that someone does or doesn't have ME/CFS has led to some practitioners dismissing it. So there aren't any biomarkers as yet that can test for it. So although with exercise physiology, we can now clearly demonstrate in a research setting that people with ME/CFS have abnormalities in energy production, this isn't particularly helpful as a test for me as a GP in my normal everyday clinic. I also think that the vagueness and the kind of fluctuation and shifting nature of the symptoms that are really typical of ME/CFS have meant that it's been quite easy for practitioners to label sufferers as either malingering, having primarily a kind of psychological condition, or enhancing symptoms for their own gain. I think the other final point to make when we're looking at kind of the myths around ME/CFS is that if you look at it compared to other chronic debilitating conditions, the funding for ME/CFS research over the years has been incredibly small. So the knock-on effects of this lack of research obviously include a lack of evidence around treatment options, but also a lack of clinical knowledge and understanding amongst health providers in pretty much all specialties, including general practice.
Thank you, Kathy. As a GP, what symptoms should I be looking for in particular if I'm considering a diagnosis of ME/CFS?
Well, I think it's fair to say, Louise, that this can be really, really confounding for a GP, including myself. And as mentioned at the start, I'm by no means expert. But patients with ME/CFS can have just a huge array of symptoms that move around the body, fluctuate in severity, and change over time. And the list is almost endless, but it includes things like dyspnea, muscle pain and weakness, flu-like symptoms, temperature dysregulation, vertigo, reduced functionality, photophobia. Patients can have hypersomnia or insomnia, mast cell activation syndrome, swollen lymph nodes, anemia, chest pain, GI dysfunction, slowed speech, orthostatic intolerance or POTS, profound fatigue, depression, headaches, cognitive impairment, food intolerances, and honestly, the list goes on and on and on. So although in this huge list, it seems like there's this kind of totally disconnected array of symptoms, there are some key ones that can be a bit of a red flag and will point you towards a diagnosis of ME/CFS. So the first one of these is reduced functionality. This is really, really crucial. So people with ME/CFS have a substantial reduction or impairment in their ability to engage in pre-illness levels of either educational, social, occupational, or personal activities. And this reduced functionality needs to persist for at least 6 months to meet the threshold for diagnosis. Profound fatigue is a key symptom, and this can include physical, cognitive, as well as emotional fatigue. And the fatigue in ME/CFS needs to be of new or definite onset, so it can't have been there for life, and it also can't be the result of ongoing excessive exertion. It's important also that fatigue is not substantially alleviated by rest. So sufferers with ME/CFS will say, look, I'm tired regardless of whether or not I've had a nap or I've done nothing all day or not. Unrefreshing sleep. So those patients that come in and say, actually, I sleep brilliantly, but I wake up in the morning and I'm always exhausted. Cognitive impairment or brain fog is another key feature. And particularly in young people, this is present in around 90% of young people with ME/CFS, is orthostatic intolerance or POTS. So those sensations of feeling dizzy, overwhelmed, collapsing, faintness, racing heart rate when standing or upright is really key for young people who have ME/CFS. And lastly, post-exertional malaise, which is a symptom that is pretty unique to ME/CFS, particularly in adult patients. And this was a symptom that I knew almost nothing about until I did a wee bit more kind of learning in this space.
I wonder, Kathy, can we touch on that post-exertional malaise, seeing that it does seem to be quite unique to ME/CFS? Can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
Absolutely. So it's defined by a worsening of symptoms, and it's not just fatigue. So it can be other symptoms as well, like just really feeling unwell, physically unwell, for a period of time after some form of exertion. And it's usually delayed by anything from a few hours after the exertion to up to around 72 hours after. And so it can be really hard to predict and recognize that the kind of deterioration in how you're feeling has actually been prompted by something you might have done up to 3 days before. And it's especially hard to predict and recognize in younger people. It's also the symptom that is responsible for what's known as the push-crash cycle. So on a good day, a person with ME/CFS may actually be pushing themselves to do a little bit more because they feel quite good, but then they will crash a day or two afterwards and experience a worsening of symptoms as a result. And the exertion that's required to trigger post-exertional malaise, it's really interesting. It can be mental or emotional, not just physical. And for people at the severe end of the spectrum, it can be what we would consider as really, really minor. So it could include something like brushing their teeth or having a conversation with a friend. And that may be enough to trigger that crash cycle. So other triggers can include, so if you think about physical exertion, so that might be, you know, going for exercise such as walking or running, or it could be as simple as just having a shower or even chewing some food. Orthostatic exertion is another thing that can bring on PEM. It takes more energy to sit or stand up compared to lying down. Mental exertion can be a trigger. So that might include things like planning to do some work, reading, writing some schoolwork, or even thinking about doing some schoolwork can be enough to trigger it. Strong emotions, so all types of emotions, including happy ones, an overloading of the senses, so lots of noise, light, touch, smell, being in a busy room, for example, can be really overwhelming and can trigger post-exertional malaise. Stress can, and that can be stress in a study or school setting for young people, could be stress in relationships and friendships, or financial stress due to not being able to work because of their illness. And also fighting infections or other illnesses. So post-exertional malaise can be triggered by a whole variety of things. And although it's considered to be a really key feature and quite unique to ME/CFS, as it's hard to recognize in younger people, I think the advice for practitioners is if it's not obviously present in a young person, it doesn't mean they don't have ME/CFS.
Great. Thank you for that, Kathy. So thinking now about investigations, given that the causes can be wide and varied, are there any investigations that you would recommend we should do in primary care?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most important thing, firstly, is to do a thorough assessment, including a physical examination, to rule out other coexisting or underlying conditions. And I will often go back to the kind of first base when a patient joins my list or sees me for the first time, because you never quite know what was done in the first place to reach that diagnosis. So even if someone comes to you already with the label of ME/CFS, I think it's important to revisit those basics. I'd then suggest some routine blood tests. Now, these are often normal, but if they do turn up something like iron deficiency or an underactive thyroid, for example, it's really important to know about that and treat it. So the baseline bloods I do vary a little bit from patient to patient, but they would usually include a complete blood count, CRP, ferritin, electrolytes, renal and liver function, calcium, magnesium, blood glucose, thyroid function, vitamin D12, folate, vitamin D, and celiac. And then depending on the other symptoms that are present, you might also want to think about doing the kind of autoimmune type testing. So the immunoglobulins, antinuclear antibodies, those bits and pieces, as well as a CK and cortisol. And if you're thinking there might have been a viral trigger, you can consider serology. So that might be things like EBV, HIV, CMV, and of course now COVID serology as well. The other assessment that you can do in your clinic is to test for the presence of orthostatic intolerance. So most commonly in young people, that will be either orthostatic hypertension or POTS. And as mentioned, over 90% of young people with ME have orthostatic intolerance. And it is super important to discover those that do, as treating it actually really improves malaise and quality of life, even if patients aren't recognizing that as the kind of most dominant or most impacting symptom. Now, you can assess this reasonably easily in your clinic using something called the poor man's tilt test, but you do need a wee bit of time. And you can look up the poor man's tilt test online if you need a wee bit more detail, but the basic premise is you get your patient to lie down for around 10 minutes and you monitor their heart rate, and then you ask them to stand up and not move. And not moving includes not fidgeting or moving their feet, as that will invalidate what you're going to see. You then keep monitoring their heart rate for a further 10 minutes, and a sustained increase of 40 beats a minute over their baseline or sustained heart rate over 120 beats per minute is diagnostic of POTS. And get your patient to report symptoms as they do this, and be really careful to stop the test if they become very symptomatic, as they can faint on you, which is not what you want in the clinic. So I tend to do this very close to a wall and close to a chair. So if they need to suddenly sit down or rest back against the wall, they can do. And it can be really enlightening. I did this on someone in my clinic a couple of weeks ago, and it was so dramatic that I think it's a relatively easy thing to do. And certainly a patient will have to wait a lot less time than if you refer them for the official kind of tilt table test for this.
So Kathy, I just wondered, is there a tool or a diagnostic criteria that we should be looking at and referring to in order to make this diagnosis?
Yes, currently the recommendation in New Zealand is to use the Institute of Medicine Diagnostic Criteria, and they list those symptoms that we've touched on already, Louise. So those include the loss of functionality, the fatigue despite good sleep sometimes, the orthostatic intolerance, the brain fog, and the post-exertional malaise. And that combination of symptoms should have been present for at least 6 months to fulfill the diagnosis of ME/CFS.
Great. Thank you for that, Kathy. And we'll link that into our reference section. So I'd like to pull into the conversation Noah and his mum, Rose. So Noah has had ME/CFS and is just going to talk to us about the impact that this has had on his life. So welcome, Noah, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I just want to start out by kind of reciting how one of my doctor's appointments went for me. So I went to see a new doctor at the hospital a few weeks ago. I talked about how this all started about 4 years ago and what my days were like now. I've been sick for about 4 years and 2 years quite severely. I described the high heart rate, the breathlessness, the chest pain, the lightheadedness, the adrenaline spikes, the exhaustion, the head buzzing, the nausea, the loss of appetite, the disorientation, and the headaches, just to name a few. I also talked about how during a bad patch, my eyesight is affected. My skin pricks and tingles, and I can't form a thought or words properly. My days and nights are reversed, and I can't sleep, but I am overwhelmed by tiredness. I explained that I have not been able to go to school or do any schoolwork in 2 years. I think the doctor saw that I was doing quite well at the moment, and I was able to walk into the office and I could tell her reasonably coherent story. What I didn't say or talk about was that this was the first time that I had left the house in around a month, and that for the past week I had been saving my energy for this appointment. I also didn't say how being at the appointment would impact me, about the following week that would be mostly spent lying down, unable to manage any kind of effort or stimulation. Coming to the appointment was a huge investment. And it's unclear whether those investments pay off. I'm genuinely not sure of what he thought of me and of my situation. We didn't really discuss it. I got an appointment in the mail for us to meet in 5 months. I had already waited 6 months for our appointment. And a year is a really long time when you're 16. I and many others like me with this condition have lost almost everything in our lives. Any description of what this is like would only understate the effects that chronic illnesses, especially this one, has on young people. I have lost my friends. I have lost all of my hobbies. I have lost my education. I have lost my social skills, my freedom. I have lost my fitness. I have lost my intelligence. And I feel like I'm slowly losing my hope. This is on top of feeling like crap for 24/7. The fact that so many of us have to deal with this loss, some without the amazing family support that I have received, means that many of us do develop mental health problems. For me, it has been primarily anxiety. I am anxious for my future. I am anxious that my body is failing me. I am anxious that I won't be able to deal with the symptoms that seem to come from nowhere. I am anxious about being alone, anxious that if I do too much, my condition will get worse, anxious that if I don't do enough, my condition will get worse. I'm anxious that when I see a doctor, they won't see how hard this is. I'm afraid that only the anxiety will be seen. While my parents have tried to protect me from knowing this, what I have slowly learned to learned is that a scarily large proportion of people, including doctors, still form a direct link between this anxiety and the symptoms of my condition. Please do not be quick to make hasty judgment. It gaslights us and it makes things worse. To say that anxiety and mental health problems cause this condition is like saying PTSD caused World War II. If any of them knew anything about how hard this is to deal with, they would not question the reality of this condition. They would not question the mental health aspect of it. What I do need is time, and it will take time for a doctor to get to know me and this really complicated problem that I have. It changes constantly. And if I am only seen when a problem has overwhelmed me, then you will not get to know its patterns or the way all of the symptoms are connected. I know that the time I am asking is in very short supply for doctors, and my teenage years are in short supply too, and I need all the help that I can get. And I'm really lucky to have a really considerate and kind GP, although not all the doctors that I have talked to and had appointments with over the years have been as kind. I do know that there are too many people with conditions like mine that have absolutely no support from GPs or from doctors. And to try and navigate that that maze is just really, really hard, I would imagine. So just any kind of support that, or even just emotional support that doctors, I think, can provide people like me really goes a long way. That's pretty much all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Noah, for that. That's a really valuable dialogue to have, and I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about that. And I think it will stick heavily and stay with lots of us. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So thank you, Rose, for letting Noah talk to us. I just wonder if you had some comments that you wanted to make as well.
Yeah, kia ora koutou. You know, I feel really privileged to introduce everybody to my amazing 16-year-old. He's obviously a very unwell kid, but not able to do much at all, but he spent his precious energy on that for you all. So I hope that added something to the picture. What I wanted to do is to just draw from some of the things that Noah talked about and from my experience of caring for family members with ME/CFS, and just to let you know Noah's not the only family member. And from my years of being involved with patient groups and advocacy, I've had my ear to the ground with this patient group, with the research, with the clinicians for around 8 years. So for me, it's been almost total immersion, which, you know, obviously at times puts you right at the front of learning new things. So I think the first thing that Noah was talking about is the importance of taking time to get to know the person. And one of the things that we have done in our family is to set up a schedule of regular appointments. So Noah has an appointment, or we at least try to have an appointment once a month, and that goes on regardless with his GP, who's always really curious about the good, the bad, and the ugly with Noah, and has got to know him really, really well. So what happens when we're able to do that is that the support and management can be planned and not reactive. So what we found was that snapshot appointments gave a picture of seemingly random and wandering symptoms, and it was really difficult to get a handle on what to prioritize and how to understand this person. You will have heard from the list of Noah's symptoms and from the list that Kathy talked about that somebody might come in with a particular symptom, might come in with a story. And with ME/CFS, what that will be the needle, and what the doctors need to do is look for the haystack. And the only way of doing that is by spending that time. So we've got Noah on the Care Plus initiative, which means that his appointments are cheaper and there's various resources for the practice to support him through that process. That works really well. And that way we can kind of predict and stage the kind of support that he needs and prioritize things. The other thing that he mentioned with regard to taking time is that the secondary services are very unlikely to be familiar with this condition. And I think it's often a great comfort to general practitioners that they can send somebody off to the experts. Unfortunately, in New Zealand, there aren't any experts, and there's only a few people who have really taken a prolonged interest in ME/CFS. So it is really difficult to find somebody who won't be starting from scratch with understanding this condition, and the potential that they may misunderstand or end up recommending inappropriate or even harmful strategies for that person is reasonably high. I think Kathy alluded earlier to our growing understanding of the kinds of things that can support as well as the things that have been proven to harm. So it's taking a while for those to move out of common practice. The other thing about these, about secondary services, as I'm sure you're all really well aware, they're not set up to treat the whole person. They're set up to treat organ systems. And ME/CFS is a whole person condition. It does impact most of the person's systems. Overseas, patients will see that MDTs are often available. As they are for elderly here, really, you might see a neurologist and a cardiologist, a rheumatologist, an immunologist, a physio, an OT, and you'd have a suite of professionals, of experts to support you depending on what the needs are at that time. And that's not possible here in New Zealand. The piece that Noah talked about it taking sort of 6 months to get the first appointment, 5 months to get the next, is not in any way an exaggeration. He's just been waiting 7 months for a neurologist appointment, and it's nowhere near on the horizon yet. And he's got severe neurological impacts from his condition. So that's a tricky thing. So the GPs really are on the front line, really, with this. And most of what people with ME/CFS need can be provided by general practitioners. But it does require that you get to know this pattern, get to know the person. So, recommend taking that time and making sure that the appointments are regularly scheduled. The other thing that I think Noah alluded to is the importance of partnering with your patients. And general practitioners are good at this. This is what they do. I think this is a really interesting time for people with ME. Post-viral illnesses are in the focus. Long COVID is gaining recognition. It's been called a mass disability event. And I think New Zealand will be lucky to escape the worst of that because of a combination of avoiding the worst variants of COVID, but also because of the vaccinations. We won't escape it altogether. So in terms of a growing recognition, I think we're in a really interesting place. A significant portion of people with long COVID will get a diagnosis of ME/CFS after 6 months. And just one little fact that I plucked out is that in the UK, 31,000 children have had long COVID for 12 months or more. So this is going to be a condition that we're going to have to really get to grips with. So until just a year or two ago, even the world's leading ME/CFS researcher, who's a scientist at Stanford and was directly involved in the original mapping of the genome, so a really preeminent scientist, was having to crowdfund the research money for his ME/CFS research. So we're really looking forward to more research. The difficulty is that it's not here yet. And so general practitioners are in that really difficult space of their patients often seeking information, seeking literature, looking to overseas patient groups and connecting very broadly and wanting to try things. A lot of these things are not in common practice here yet. What can really help, though, is to connect your patients with the advocacy and the practical support that is available. So Some of that practical support is around acknowledging that families in particular may have lost an income if they're caring for a young person. We certainly have in our family. So they may be entirely unfamiliar with the benefit system and may need some help navigating that. Things like disability parking, home help and respite for carers can be really helpful, and equipment for mobility or for tasks around the home. What I would say, though, is that this is a lot more difficult for people with ME than it is for people with other disabilities, because ME is not considered a disability in the same way that multiple sclerosis or motor neuron disease or some of the other really disabling conditions are. And so ME is not covered by disability support services. And we're left having to use the long-term support and chronic health conditions pathway, which is a lot more opaque and a lot less well-resourced. So even people who are completely dependent, bed-bound, unable to toilet, unable to feed themselves, are really struggling to get any help because the pathways are just simply not there. For young people, things like support around accessing education accommodations is really something that the general practitioners can be very helpful with. So there is really good information on the CDC website and on other guidelines as to the kinds of accommodations that young people might need. And then you have the option of the health school, which is able to come alongside people who are not able to attend school in person. For us, that's not been possible. Mel's not well enough to access either of those, which we're hoping to eventually get back to. So the support networks in New Zealand are, you know, gathering some real strength. And partly this is around, I guess, coming to some sort of maturity and finding a real synergy in the kind of work that we're all doing. And so we've got the main organisation in New Zealand is the Associated New Zealand ME Society, and they have a really well-trodden path of advocacy and information. And then there's ME awareness that is aligned itself with education, particularly around education for doctors and general practitioners in particular. And then there is a network of support organisations. None of these are funded, so they're all voluntary, and almost everybody is somebody who has ME. So within each region, you'll be able to find a support network. The Chronic Complex Illness organisation is in Tauranga, Wellington and the Waikato, and they are really galvanising their support at the moment, have groups and various other resources for people. So it's definitely worth looking out for that. And you will find on both the ANSME, that's the Associated New Zealand ME Society website, and the ME Awareness website can point you in the right direction for that. The final and possibly the most important point that Noah made, he wanted to let you know that ME can have an impact on mental health and that this is consequent to the losses and the experience of the condition. Noah was, and in many respects is, a confident, social, ambitious, intelligent young man. He thrived in the company of his good friends, and being abandoned by your health is impossibly hard. Being also abandoned by your friends and dislocated from any of the other structures that teenagers usually connect with is even harder. So the downstream effects of this are almost inevitable. The point that I want to add to that is from the perspective of a parent. You know, as a parent, I can never shake the feeling that there might have been something that I did or that I didn't do that contributed, or that there is something that's just out of my reach that might make a difference. So this is really relentless and exhausting for families. So it's not just the kids with ME who have experienced huge loss. The families are also derailed. For example, as a family, we've not left the house together for almost 8 years. So with the arrival of long COVID, people with ME at last seeing a little bit of hope. Attention and funding is at least internationally going into research, and programs of support and management are emerging. So we hope that the balance of understanding is rapidly shifting, and post-viral illnesses broadly are getting some of the attention that they've deserved for many decades.
Thank you, Rose. Some really, really relevant points. And I thank you for sharing those with us. Kathy, I wonder if we can touch, please, on management for a moment. Can you comment on what management we should be offering our patients and what has a scientific basis?
Absolutely. And I think some of the points made so eloquently and intelligently and with such insight by Rose and Noah are actually incredibly important for GPs. So doing those basics well, you know, making sure that families understand the pathways for financial support, for support around education, all of those things I think are really, really important. And that's our role as a GP and to be their advocate as well. A kind of low, slow approach to any medication is really, really important. So an example might be, I will quite often trial low-dose amitriptyline for my patients with ME/CFS, particularly if they've got issues with pain or poor sleep. And I would tend to start this at a super low dose. There might even be 2.5 milligrams and titrate up really, really slowly compared to a dose that I might start another patient on who had similar symptoms but didn't have ME/CFS. Now, Rose alluded to this, but the other thing that I do that I think is really important is I schedule regular appointments for my patients with ME/CFS so that we can progress through the plan and that list of symptoms in a sort of proactive rather than a reactive way. Now, obviously, it gets derailed sometimes if there is a flare-up in symptoms, but I think it's really important to try and manage things in a planned way. And as Rose said, look for funding options so that you are subsidizing those consultations if you possibly can. Now, in terms of medications, as we said, there are no current approved treatments or cures, but we are hopeful that as new research emerges, that's something that's going to change in the near future. There isn't definitive evidence around supplementation, but many people with ME will want to experiment and see what works for them. And the things that anecdotally I have found have been effective for my patients, and that if you look at a lot of the international websites people have found as well, are things like B12, vitamin D and coenzyme Q10. Now, coenzyme Q10 is not one that we can prescribe, but patients can buy this over the counter, but we can prescribe vitamin B12 and vitamin D. And I do this for my patients to see if there's any benefit. When I'm doing anything like this, I try to encourage them to just use one thing at a time so that we can either include it as a treatment option if they get some benefit or discount it if they clearly don't before moving on to the next one. Now, Rose also mentioned this, but as evidence for drug treatments emerges, it is really likely, and this is absolutely true for my patients, that they are more aware of the emerging research than I am. So they will often bring me the latest trials or papers or evidence from overseas looking at medication A, B, or C. And I guess it's a bit of a negotiation and a partnership around, do you feel comfortable prescribing some of those things at low dose? Do you feel like it's within your scope? Or do you feel like at present, the risks or the potential harm might outweigh the potential benefit? In which case, that's a conversation where I would say, hey, it looks like this might be promising, but this trial's actually really, really small. And I think we might need to wait a little bit before we embark on thinking about that as a prescribed medication. And then Rose talked about this as well, and as did Noah, but I think doing the basics well is so, so important. So listening, partnering, affirming and validating how incredibly difficult this is for not only your patient, but also for their whānau and their care support people. I think about offering telehealth appointments because sometimes that's the only way you can connect with a person who has ME/CFS. It may simply be way too exhausting to come to the clinic. Try and keep up to date with health pathways. And if there are any local or regional GPs or specialists who have at least an interest in this, connect with them if you've got a patient that is struggling to know how to support and help. Rose talked about WINS and other financial avenues. I think it's really important that we advocate super strongly in that space. And also around, you know, the schooling, education, mobility, social connection, the other bits and pieces as well. So I think Rose and Noah summed it up way more beautifully than I ever could. But I think being open to ideas, having a partnership approach, and being as supportive as you possibly can, recognizing that this is an extremely debilitating condition for some families and some individuals, I think if you can do that well, you're going to be a long way ahead of the game for the kind of healthcare that some of these patients still sadly get offered.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for your time today and Noah as well. And to conclude our podcast, Kathy, would you like to sum it up and give us some take-home messages, please?
Absolutely. And thank you again, Louise. It's a huge privilege to be involved in these podcasts. So we really appreciate the opportunity. I think the first take-home message would be, you know, consider ME/CFS as a diagnosis. If you're seeing a young person who isn't functioning as they used to be, or presents with a variety of vague yet really kind of impacting symptoms, it's commoner than you think. I think the most important symptom, particularly in adults, but also in some young people as well, is that post-exertional malaise. And as it's not one that we are particularly familiar with as GPs, important to get your head around how that might present. And although bloods and other tests are usually normal, it is important to do them to make sure you're not missing an alternative or coexisting treatable condition. Support is available, and Rose has mentioned some of the avenues that you can find that through, and those websites will be available on GoodFellow. And lastly, please, please don't underestimate how impacting ME/CFS is. I think Noah's words are just extraordinary and say far more eloquently than I ever could how incredibly hard this can be for both the sufferer and the family. So as GPs, don't underestimate it.
Great. Thank you so much to our guests today, to Kathy, to Rose and Noah. It's been an absolute pleasure having you with us.
Thank you, Louise.